A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Picture this. You're at 40,000 feet, somewhere over the Atlantic, middle of the night. The cabin's dark, most people are asleep. And then a white flash, a bang that's more felt than heard, and the whole plane shudders once. The guy next to you grips the armrest. You look out the window and see nothing, just cloud. And the flight attendant doesn't even pause the drink cart. That plane just took a lightning strike straight to the nose and shrugged it off like it was a bug on the windshield. Daniel's been thinking about this. The fact that lightning is just electricity hunting for the easiest route to ground, and yet two of the most common tall conductive things we build, aircraft and skyscrapers, get hit all the time and somehow survive. He wanted to know the physics of why they attract strikes, the specific engineering that lets them take the hit, and how the two protection strategies compare. So we're going to start with the strike itself. What's actually happening in that flash? Then walk through the aircraft's skin and the skyscraper's bones, and then put them side by side. They're more different than most people assume.
The thing about lightning that most explanations skip is the scale. We're talking about a discharge that can reach 300 million volts and carry 30,000 amps. The air around the bolt heats to about 30,000 degrees Celsius in microseconds. That's 5 times hotter than the surface of the sun. And the whole event, from the first leader reaching down to the return stroke blasting back up, is over in a few tenths of a second.
So the plane's not just getting zapped. It's getting zapped by something that turns air into plasma.
Right. And here's the counterintuitive part. Lightning doesn't actually target anything. A stepped leader propagates downward from the cloud in 50-meter jumps, branching and feeling its way through the air. It's looking for the path of least resistance, but it doesn't know where that path is until it's about 100 meters from the ground, or from the aircraft. At that point, an upward leader launches from the object to meet it. The tall conductive object didn't attract the lightning in some magnetic sense, it just happened to be the most convenient bridge across the remaining air gap.
So the lightning was going to hit something in that general area anyway. The building or the plane just made itself the obvious choice.
And the numbers bear this out. A commercial airliner gets struck roughly once per year on average. That's per airframe, not per fleet. The Empire State Building takes 20 to 25 strikes annually. The Burj Khalifa, at 828 meters, gets hit so often that its protection system was designed from the start with maintenance access at extreme heights, because engineers knew they'd be sending crews up there regularly to inspect and replace components.
Once a year for a plane, 25 times a year for a building, and the Burj Khalifa is basically a full-time lightning rod that happens to have offices in it.
Which brings us to the fundamental distinction that drives everything else. An aircraft is a moving, isolated conductor suspended in midair. There's no ground connection. The lightning strike completes its circuit through the aircraft's body and out the other side, discharging into the surrounding air. A skyscraper is a fixed structure with a direct, deliberate connection to the Earth. One is a transient event on a flying island. The other is a permanent channel to ground. That single difference shapes every engineering decision in both systems.
So with that physics in mind, let's start with the aircraft. How do you build a plane that can take a 30,000 amp hit and keep the drinks cold?
You turn the fuselage into a Faraday cage. The principle is the same one. Michael Faraday demonstrated in 1836, a conductive shell will carry current around its exterior, leaving the interior field free. If you're sitting inside an aluminum tube, the lightning current travels along the skin around you and exits somewhere else. You never become part of the circuit.
And this is the same reason a car is safe in a thunderstorm. Not the rubber tires, which is what everyone thinks, but the metal body.
The tires are completely irrelevant. A lightning bolt that just jumped 3 kilometers through open air isn't going to be stopped by 6 inches of rubber. The car's body is the Faraday cage. The tires might as well be made of cheese for all the difference they make.
I'm going to enjoy watching people unlearn that one.
On a conventional aluminum-skinned aircraft, the skin itself is the conductor. Aluminum is about 60% as conductive as copper, but much lighter, and there's a lot of it. The entire outer surface of the plane is a continuous electrical path. When a strike attaches, usually at the nose or wingtip, the current spreads out across the skin and exits at another extremity, typically the tail. The whole thing takes milliseconds.
But planes aren't all aluminum anymore. The 787, the A350, these are composite aircraft. Carbon fiber isn't conductive the way aluminum is.
And that was a massive engineering challenge. Carbon fiber reinforced polymer is strong and light, but it's a terrible electrical conductor. In fact, it's resistive enough that a lightning strike could cause localized heating, delamination, even structural damage if the current couldn't spread out fast enough. Boeing's solution on the 787 was to embed an expanded copper foil mesh, about a tenth of a millimeter thick, into the outer layers of the composite skin. It's laid up with the carbon fiber plies during manufacturing and becomes part of the structure.
A tenth of a millimeter. That's barely thicker than a sheet of paper.
And it has to be electrically continuous across every panel joint, every seam, every fastener. If there's a gap, you get arcing. The arc is hot enough to damage the composite around it. Boeing spent years developing the bonding techniques to make sure the mesh formed a single unbroken conductor across the entire airframe. It's one of those invisible engineering achievements that nobody thinks about until it fails.
So the skin handles the current path, but what's actually vulnerable inside the plane? What breaks if you get this wrong?
Fuel. That's the nightmare scenario. A spark inside a fuel tank at altitude is catastrophic. TWA 800 in 1996, though that was ignition of vapor by a wiring fault, not lightning, but the physics of what happens when fuel vapor meets an ignition source is the same. The engineering response is to make the fuel system lightning safe through bonding. Every metal component in the fuel system, pumps, valves, access panels, filler caps, is electrically connected to the airframe so that no potential difference can build up between them. If everything is at the same voltage, there's no spark.
Even the fuel itself gets engineered for this.
Jet fuel is formulated to have low static building properties. It's less volatile than gasoline. The flash point is higher. And additives reduce its tendency to accumulate charge as it flows through pipes and filters. The fuel tank vents are designed with flame arrestors, essentially fine metal mesh screens that allow air to pass but quench any flame front that tries to propagate through. And the tanks themselves are inerted on many modern aircraft. Nitrogen is pumped into the oulage space to reduce the oxygen concentration below the level that can support combustion.
So you've got multiple layers. The fuel won't spark easily. The components can't develop a voltage difference. And even if something does ignite, the flame can't spread. That's defense in depth.
And then there's the avionics. The flight control computers, the navigation systems, the engine controllers, all of it has to keep working through and after a strike. This is where surge suppression and shielding come in. The wiring bundles are shielded with braided metal sleeves, and surge protection devices at the connectors clamp any voltage spike before it reaches sensitive electronics. The industry standard for defining all of this is SAE ARP412, which divides the aircraft into lightning strike zones.
What are the zones?
Zone 1A is the initial attachment point, typically the nose, the wingtips, the engine nacelles. Zone 1B is the swept strobe zone. As the aircraft moves forward, the lightning channel gets pushed backward along the fuselage. Zone 2A is the reattachment zone, where the channel might reconnect after sweeping. Zone 3 is everything else, areas that shouldn't see direct attachment but might carry conducted current. Each zone has specific protection requirements for materials, bonding, and shielding.
So the engineers have literally mapped the surface of the plane by how likely each square inch is to get hit.
And they test it. NASA ran a program in the 1980s with an F-106B Delta Dart. They deliberately flew it into thunderstorms to study lightning strikes. Over 1,500 flight hours, that aircraft took more than 700 strikes. The onboard instruments recorded everything, where the strikes attached, how the current traveled, what the electromagnetic effects were inside the cockpit. The plane kept flying. It proved that the Faraday cage approach works, but it also gave engineers the data to refine the zone model and the protection standards.
700 strikes on one airframe. That pilot must have had a very specific relationship with fear.
Or a very good understanding of the physics. The other piece of the aircraft puzzle is static discharge. Even without a lightning strike, an aircraft builds up static charge just from friction with the air. The same principle as shuffling your feet on a carpet. If that charge builds up enough, it can create corona discharge from the extremities, which can interfere with radio communications and, in extreme cases, actually trigger a lightning strike by providing the initial leader. The solution is static wicks, those little needle-like devices you see on the trailing edges of wings and tail surfaces. They bleed off the charge gradually, reducing the voltage differential between the aircraft and the surrounding air.
They do prevent strikes, but they make the plane less likely to be the thing that initiates one.
Correct. They're passive devices. No power, no moving parts, just a conductive path with a sharp point that encourages corona discharge at low current levels.
All right, so the aircraft is a flying Faraday cage with zoned armor, inerted fuel tanks, shielded wiring, and little static bleeding needles on the wingtips. It's engineered to take a strike as a transient event. Current in, current out, everybody moves on. Now let's talk about the thing that can't move on. A skyscraper lives in the thunderstorm for decades. That changes everything.
It does, and it also simplifies one thing enormously. A skyscraper has ground, real, actual, physical earth. The entire protection strategy is built around giving the lightning a low resistance path to that ground, and making sure nothing else becomes an accidental alternate route.
The classic image is the lightning rod on the roof, the Franklin rod, which is basically unchanged in concept since Benjamin Franklin flew his kite.
The modern version is called an air terminal network. You don't just put one rod on top and call it done. You place multiple terminals across the roof and any other high points, mechanical penthouses, architectural spires, parapet walls. The spacing is determined by something called the rolling sphere method, codified in NFPA 780.
Rolling sphere. Explain that.
Imagine a sphere with a radius of 46 meters. That's the standard for ordinary structures. You roll this imaginary sphere across the roof and down the sides of the building. Any surface the sphere touches is considered vulnerable to a direct strike and needs an air terminal. Any surface the sphere can't touch, because it's tucked under an overhang or shielded by a taller element, is in the protected zone. The physics behind it's that the 46-meter radius represents the final striking distance of the upward leader. If the sphere can't reach a surface, the leader can't either.
So it's a geometric shortcut for a complex electromagnetic problem.
It's beautifully simple, and it scales. For critical structures, you use a smaller sphere radius, which means tighter terminal spacing. The Burj Khalifa uses a much more conservative radius because of its height and the frequency of strikes.
Once the strike hits the terminal, it needs to get to ground. What carries it?
Down conductors. Heavy copper or aluminum cables, typically braided for flexibility, running vertically down the building. But in modern reinforced concrete construction, the building's own steel rebar often serves as the down conductor network. The rebar cage inside the concrete columns and beams is electrically continuous, or made continuous by welding or tying the bars together at every intersection. The current splits across hundreds of parallel paths through the steel, which reduces the impedance and spreads the thermal load.
And at the bottom,
grounding electrodes. Copper-clad steel rods driven deep into the earth, or a grid of buried conductor, or both. The goal is to achieve a resistance to ground of 10 ohms or less, ideally under 5 ohms. In places with poor soil conductivity, like sandy or rocky ground, you might need multiple electrodes, chemical treatment of the soil, or even a counterpoise, a buried ring of conductor around the building's foundation.
So the path is air terminal, down conductor, ground electrode. It sounds straightforward. What makes it hard?
Side flash. That's the real danger in a building. The lightning current is flowing down the designated conductor, but if that conductor runs near any other metal, an elevator rail, a plumbing riser, an HVAC duct, a structural beam that isn't bonded, the voltage difference between the conductor and that nearby metal can get high enough to arc across the gap. Now you've got a lightning strike inside the building, jumping to something that was never designed to carry it.
And that something might be connected to sensitive equipment, or occupied spaces.
The solution is bonding. Every metallic system in the building, Elevator rails, water pipes, gas pipes, cable trays, ductwork, structural steel, reinforcing bar, metal facades, rooftop equipment gets electrically connected to the lightning protection system. If everything is bonded together, everything rises to the same potential during a strike. There's no voltage difference, so there's no arc. The technical term is equipotential bonding, and it's the single most important concept in building lightning protection.
So you're not just giving the lightning a path, you're making sure there are no other paths it might find tempting.
And then there's surge protection. A direct strike isn't the only threat. Lightning can hit a power line miles away, and the surge will travel right into the building through the electrical service. A skyscraper has thousands of tenants with computers, servers, medical equipment, all of it sensitive to voltage spikes. The protection scheme is layered. At the service entrance, you install Type 1 surge protective devices that can handle the massive energy of a near-direct strike. At distribution panels, you add Type 2 devices for intermediate protection. At the point of use, Type 3 devices. The surge strips people plug into their walls provide the final layer.
This all has to be maintained. The Burj Khalifa thing you mentioned, they designed for maintenance access at extreme heights. What does that actually mean?
It means the air terminals and conductors at the top of the building are reachable. There are built-in access points, davits for suspending maintenance platforms, and pathways for technicians to get to every component. After a known strike or on a regular inspection cycle, crews go up and check for damage. A direct hit can pit or even melt a small amount of metal at the attachment point. Over years, corrosion can degrade connections. A loose bond that was fine when installed might open up as the building settles and shifts. The system has to be inspected and tested periodically. Resistance measurements, visual checks of conductors and bonds, thermal imaging to spot hotspots.
The Empire State Building, installed in the 30s, still working fine. That's not install and forget.
It's install and maintain. The basic design is 80 plus years old and still sound, but the conductors have been replaced, the bonds have been checked and rechecked, and the system has been extended as the building systems have grown. The original Franklin rod concept is still there, but the implementation has evolved continuously.
Let's put the two side by side now. Aircraft versus skyscraper. What's the same, and what's fundamentally different?
The same, both use Faraday cage principles, both rely on conductive exteriors or embedded conductors, both bond everything metallic to prevent internal arcing, and both use surge suppression for electronics. The physics of the strike, the leader attachment, the current flow, the thermal and electromagnetic effects, is identical.
And the differences?
First, the ground connection. The aircraft has none. It's a floating node, current enters and exits through the air. The skyscraper has a deliberate, engineered path to Earth. That means the aircraft's protection has to handle the full current passing through the structure, while the skyscraper's system channels it away. Second, duration of exposure. The aircraft is in a storm cell for minutes. The building stands in thousands of storms over its lifetime. The aircraft system is designed for a few hundred strikes over a 30-year service life. The Burj Khalifa might take that many in a decade.
Third has to be the materials.
The aircraft is weight critical. Every gram of copper mesh is a gram not carrying payload or fuel. The skyscraper doesn't care about weight in the same way. A few hundred kilos of copper cable is negligible compared to the mass of the structure. So the aircraft uses exotic, optimized materials. Expanded copper foil at a tenth of a millimeter, while the building can use off-the-shelf copper braid or even the structural steel itself.
The failure modes are different.
Completely. On an aircraft, a lightning protection failure could mean a fuel tank explosion or loss of flight controls. Catastrophic, immediate, and unrecoverable. On a skyscraper, a protection failure is more likely to mean a side flash that damages equipment, starts a fire, or injures someone. Serious, but usually localized and survivable. The aircraft's protection system is a flight safety system. The building's is a life safety and property protection system. The design margins reflect that.
There's also the aesthetic dimension. Nobody cares what a 787's copper mesh looks like. It's buried under paint. But the Burj Khalifa's air terminals are integrated into the spire's architecture. They're not ugly rods sticking up. They're part of the design language.
That's a real engineering constraint. On a landmarked building, the lightning protection has to be invisible or beautiful, preferably both. The architect won't accept a forest of copper spikes on the roof. So you get concealed conductors behind facade panels, air terminals disguised as architectural features, bonding jumpers hidden inside expansion joints. It's the same physics, but the packaging is completely different.
What's the thing most people get wrong about both of these?
That lightning protection is about preventing strikes. It's not. You can't prevent a strike on a tall object in a thunderstorm. The physics doesn't allow it. The protection is about managing the strike that will inevitably happen. You're not building a shield. You're building a preferred path and hardening everything else against the consequences.
That's the Sal philosophy, isn't it?
Sal used to say, lightning doesn't care about your calculations. It's going to find the path. Your job is just to make sure that path is the one you want it to take. Sal DiMaggio. I worked for him 2 summers, 93 and 94, retrofitting old brick buildings in Boston. He'd been doing lightning protection for 40 years. Wouldn't use aluminum conductor, only solid copper. Said aluminum gets tired. I don't know if it gets tired, but I know he never had a callback.
What kind of buildings?
Churches, mostly. Old ones. Steeples are lightning magnets, and the original protection, if there was any, was usually a single rod and a rusted cable clamped to a water pipe somewhere in the basement. We'd strip it all out, install a proper air terminal network on the steeple and roof, run 2 down conductors on opposite sides of the building, drive new ground rods, then bond everything. The bell frame, the organ pipes, the heating ducts. Sal would walk through with a continuity tester and make me redo any bond that read more than 0.5 ohm.
0.5 ohm is tight.
It was excessive. But he had this thing about the building remembering. He'd say, if you don't bond the down conductor to the rebar every 10 feet, the building remembers, and 20 years later, when the mortar crumbles a little and the connection opens up, you get a side flash through the choir loft. I thought he was superstitious. Then about 10 years ago, I read about a church in Springfield. Lightning hit the steeple, current jumped from the down conductor to an unbonded bell frame, arced across to the organ console, started a fire. Nobody hurt, but the organ was destroyed. Sal would have said he told them so.
The building remembered.
It's not memory. It's deferred failure. A bond that's marginal on day one becomes a gap after enough freeze-thaw cycles and building settlement. The strike finds it eventually. Sal's half-ohm rule wasn't about the strike today. It was about the strike 30 years from now.
That's the maintenance point we were circling. You can design a perfect system, but if the bonds degrade and nobody checks, the protection walks away quietly over decades.
We'd tag every bond with a numbered brass tag and log the resistance reading. Sal kept the logs in a filing cabinet going back to the 50s. He could tell you what the resistance was on the northeast down conductor bond at St. Anthony's in 1967. I asked him once why he kept all that paper. He said it was so that when something failed, he could prove it wasn't his work.
Did anything of his ever fail?
Not that I know of, but I think he wanted to be wrong once, just to see what it looked like.
The inspection cycles on modern skyscrapers are supposed to catch exactly this. Resistance trending upward, connections loosening, corrosion starting. But it's only as good as the people doing it. And on a lot of buildings, lightning protection inspection is a checkbox item. Nobody's logging half-ohm bonds with brass tags anymore.
The aircraft side has the advantage of being on a strict maintenance schedule, by regulation. Every 100 hours, every A-check, every C-check, someone's looking at the static wicks and the bonding jumpers. The building might go years between inspections.
Or decades. I've seen it.
Which brings us to the open question. We're building taller, and we're building aircraft with more composites, more electric systems, more fly-by-wire. The 787 is basically a flying computer wrapped in a copper mesh. The next generation of urban air mobility vehicles, EVTOLs, air taxis, are small, composite-heavy, and they'll be operating at low altitude in urban canyons, surrounded by buildings that are also getting struck. That's a new lightning protection problem that doesn't fit neatly into either the aircraft or the skyscraper model.
A small composite aircraft hovering between 2 glass towers in a thunderstorm. It's not isolated like an airliner at 40,000 feet, and it's not grounded like a building. It's somewhere in between, and the existing standards weren't written for it.
There's also research into active lightning protection, systems that sense the buildup of charge and try to prevent the strike from attaching at all. The idea is to emit a controlled corona discharge that bleeds off the charge before the leader can form, or to create an ion cloud above the structure that diverts the strike. None of it's proven at scale yet, but if it works, it'd flip the paradigm from manage the strike to prevent the strike.
Which is what everyone already thinks a lightning rod does.
The misconception is so deep that the real engineering sounds like a letdown. We don't stop the lightning, we just give it a nice path and hope it doesn't get creative.
If you take one thing from this, it's that lightning protection isn't a shield. It's a hospitality strategy. You're not keeping the lightning out. You're rolling out a red carpet and making sure it goes exactly where you want it, because it's coming in either way.
The difference between a 787 and a Burj Khalifa is just where the red carpet leads. On the plane, it leads through the skin and out the tail. On the building, it leads straight into the earth. Same physics, same principle, completely different engineering.
Which is Daniel's whole question, really. How two things that look so different from the outside are solving the exact same problem with the exact same fundamental idea, just adapted to their constraints.
That's the elegant part. The Faraday cage is almost 200 years old, and we're still finding new ways to apply it.
Thanks to Daniel for the prompt. If you've got a weird question about how something works, or doesn't, send it in. The show lives on those, myweirdprompts.com, or email show at myweirdprompts.com.
Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for producing. We'll be back soon.
This has been My Weird Props.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Props, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from long ear. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.